This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Long May She Reign by Rhiannon Thomas, narrated by Amanda Dolan. 1. 100 doves burst out of the pie. I don't know why I was surprised. Of course there were 100 doves in the pie. The king wouldn't open his birthday celebration by actually feeding his guests, not when he could amaze us all with his extravagance instead. I just wished someone had considered what would happen to the doves after they were released. The king had skewered a couple in his enthusiasm to cut open the pastry, and the survivors were determined to get as far away from that knife-wielding maniac as possible. Many of them settled in the rafters of the banquet hall, 40 feet above us. More crashed against the huge arched windows, their claws and beaks scraping the glass. One settled in the bell of a trumpet and refused to move, no matter how violently the player waved his hands. I sank into my chair and kept watch on the doves overhead. I wasn't afraid of them. Not exactly, but I already felt on edge with the entire court around me, with their judging eyes and vicious whispers, surrounded by gold and laughter and fountains of wine, and the doves were moving so erratically, flapping and skittering. I knew they wouldn't touch me, but I jumped every time they swooped either way. If only the king would serve the first course, then I'd be one step closer to leaving. My father usually allowed me to skip the king's festivities. As the king's fourth cousin once removed, I was hardly considered important, but this time my father had insisted I attend, to represent the family, to show we were people who mattered. He couldn't really have believed that would work. No one had spoken to me since I'd arrived. Even my father had abandoned me for necessary business conversations on the other side of the hall. So I sat at my table near the door, empty seats on either side of me, half wanting to join in the conversation of the people opposite, too scared to appear to be eavesdropping on them to try. King Jorgen, for his part, looked completely relaxed and completely unconcerned about his potentially starving guests. He lounged on his throne, legs thrown over one arm, his golden goblet full of wine, his golden plate free of food, while the golden paneling glittered on the wall behind him. He was talking to a girl about my age, whose smile was so wide that the corners might have been pinned to her cheeks. The king raised his goblet to her lips. When she shook her head, still smiling that strained smile, he tossed the goblet over his shoulder, wine and all. "This drink does not please my lady," he shouted. "Bring us something better." Queen Martha sat on his right. I'd always thought she looked like a praying mantis, tall, thin, and bug-eyed, with a ruthless personality to match. Her dress was the biggest in the room, with silk ribbon at the end of every layer, like icing on a cake. Her hair reached up toward the ceiling, studded with berries. She held a peacock feather fan in front of her mouth to hide her yawn, and pointedly avoided looking at her husband. A dove landed next to my still empty plate and fluffed its wings. It looked at the foodless platter and then looked at me, as though blaming me for the lack of treats. "I know." I ran my fingers along the feathers at its neck. They were softer than I'd expected, and pristine white. Only the best could be baked in the king's pies, I supposed. "I'm hungry, too."
"Freya, what are you doing?"
Sophia, the woman sitting opposite me, waved a ring-covered hand in my direction. She was in her 40s, her hair a rich henna red. A black silk moon and 2 stars had been stuck to her forehead, either as an affectation or to conceal any scars.
"Don't encourage it. It's filthy.
Pigeons all over the tables,"
Sophia's neighbor, Claire, said. She was in her 40s, too, and rather portly, with a silk heart placed to the right of her pink lips.
"I suppose the pie was entertaining, but doves," I said without thinking.
Claire raised a single, perfectly arched eyebrow.
"What was that?"
"Doves," I repeated, a little louder, forcing the word out. "They're not pigeons, they're doves."
Claire laughed.
Oh, Freya, you are strange. She waved carelessly at the bird. Pigeon, dove, whatever it is, we really don't want it on the table.
I pulled my hand back and stared at my plate as she shooed the bird away. People had been calling me strange since I learned how to talk, although usually they only said it when they thought I couldn't hear. When I was younger, I had chattered constantly, stumbling over the words in my eagerness to express them, asking question after question until I was at least 5 explanations deep. People commented on my strangeness to my mother, as though she had somehow missed it and would surely take action now it was revealed to her, but she would just laugh and say, "Isn't it wonderful?" Like my strangeness was my greatest strength. Even then, I'd known what it meant, that something was wrong with me, that I didn't belong. Then, my mother had died, and my strangeness had become far more concerning, an insult to her memory, an accusation. Why can't you be more like your mother and less like you? I was fine, I told myself. Claire should have been the one embarrassed for making such a stupid mistake about the birds. It was fine. But whenever I tried to convince myself my worries were all imaginary, that no one judged me, I remembered every scrap of evidence I'd ever gathered to the contrary. Every time someone had snickered after I spoke, every sideways glance shared by friends when I approached. The moment I had walked away from Rosalind Hayes and her friends and heard them repeating my words in high-pitched, laughing voices. I'd been reluctant to say anything to anyone after that. At first, my father had comforted me.
"Court is an odd place, but you'll get used to it. You'll make friends. You'll figure it out."
But I continued to stumble, and "you'll make friends" became "you'll survive" became "Freya, could you at least try for my sake?" 5 years later, I still had no place here. Or I did, but it was sitting by the wall, practically invisible, the butt of jokes if I was mentioned at all. Awkward Freya, strange Freya, silent, stuttering Freya, who said rude things by accident and was so very, very plain. Did you hear she does experiments in her cellar? Did you hear she nearly burned her house to the ground? What was she even doing in court, behaving like that? Or that's what I assumed. No one gossiped about me in front of my face. No one said much to or about me at all. I decided long ago that I didn't care. I was going to escape this court as soon as I could. My father insisted I had to try and find a good match, to get married and play a role in court life, but no one had ever shown any interest in me. I'd never found anyone who interested me, either. As soon as my father accepted that, I'd be gone. I'd travel to the continent, perhaps, where research was taken far more seriously, and conduct my experiments there. One day soon. Because, it turned out, I did care. I cared what people thought of me. I cared what they were saying, and I needed to get out before their judgment changed me. "Hi, Freya." I turned toward the voice, smiling. I'd only ever had one good friend, but Naomi was so wonderful that I couldn't imagine needing anyone else. She'd been drawn to me somehow, when she first moved to the capital with her brother Jacob, joining me in the corner of awkwardness and pulling me into quiet conversation. We had little in common as far as interests went. She loved novels, stories, romance, and adventure, while I was much happier with equations and research, but our souls clicked. She looked pretty tonight. She always looked pretty. Not the court's version of beauty, but something softer and sweeter. She had large brown eyes, a tiny pug nose, and ever-present dimples. Her black hair was piled in a dome on top of her head, every twist studded with a gem, and her dark skin shimmered with whichever crushed jewel powder was currently in fashion. "Hi," I said. She slipped onto the chair beside me,
wobbling slightly as she maneuvered her massive skirts into place.
"Should you be sitting here, Naomi?" Sophia said. "Not that we aren't delighted to have your company, but His Majesty worked so hard on the seating arrangements. His Majesty won't mind if I sit here for 2 minutes, I don't think," Naomi said, although she looked down as she said it, her expression unsure. She ducked closer to me.
"The people at my table are horrid," she murmured.
"And you're surprised?"
"I guess not. But then, my brother abandoned me, so it was just me thrown to the wolves. How are you coping?"
"I'm alive. That's something, isn't it?"
"Here? Definitely."
"What are you girls whispering about?" Claire said. "It's awfully rude to have secrets, you know. We'll be thinking you're talking about us next."
"We'd never gossip about you," Naomi said. She glanced at the table again, then quickly back at Claire, correcting her gaze. "What would we even say?"
"Lots of things," I thought, but Naomi probably meant it.
She made fun of the court, but she was always eager to forgive the courtiers themselves for their cruelty and vanity. Every insult became a harmless misunderstanding, or good people having a bad day, if you allowed Naomi to sit with the story long enough.
"Well, I hope I'm not that boring," Claire said.
"Tell us," Sophia said, leaning forward slightly. "How is your brother Jacob?"
"He's, well, thank you."
"What a handsome young man. I suppose he'll be finding a girl soon. Or is he enjoying life too much to settle down?"
"I don't know," Naomi said.
"You'd have to ask him."
"But surely, as his sister, you must have some inkling. Women's intuition, no? Young men so rarely know what they want. But you must have a feeling."
"What about Madeline Wolfe?" Claire said.
"She's not connected to anyone, is she? They would be a wonderful couple. Think how beautiful their children would be."
"Yes," Sophia said.
"Is your brother close to her, Naomi? We should arrange an introduction when she returns from her estate. Something so adorable, they can't help but fall in love."
Naomi was saved from answering by a hush that descended on the room. The king had stood, arms swept out toward the crowd.
"Before we enjoy our next course," he said, "I've arranged a little entertainment."
Other rulers probably had entertainments arranged for them on their birthday, but the king would never leave anything to chance. He had to show how extravagant and benevolent he was, and that meant planning every detail himself. A troop of performers ran into the hall through its rear doors. One woman backflipped her way along the hall, passing just behind Maya and Naomi's chairs. She shot us a sideways grin as she went. She was followed by more acrobats, people cartwheeling, a man walking on his hands, and jugglers, too, rings flying through the air. Their outfits sparkled, catching the light as they danced, so it almost hurt to look at them. When they reached the front of the room, they bowed to the king before continuing their performance. One of the jugglers clapped, the sound chasing through the room like thunder, and their rings seemed to transform into knives. I looked past them to the high table. The king's best friend, Torsten Wolf, sat two seats to the king's left. He looked distinctly unamused. But Torsten Wolf always looked distinctly unamused. If he ever smiled, his face would probably shatter. He was much younger than the king, probably in his early 20s, but they were inseparable. It often seemed as though the king gave Sten all of his worries to carry, leaving himself as the carefree side of the pair. For once, I felt a connection with Sten. He looked as uncomfortable as I felt. One of the performers clapped her hands, and the juggling knives burst into flame. The court gasped and applauded as the group continued to juggle, continued to dance and contort, the flames flying through the air so fast they became a blur. More performers ran in from the sides, holding torches aloft. They threw them into the paths of the burning knives so they caught fire too, and then the performers bent back, faces to the ceiling, mouths open wide, as they seemed to swallow the fire.
Then they started to breathe fire, shooting streams into the air. It caught on ribbon hung across the ceiling, too thin to be visible before, and raced along it, spelling out the king's name. The crowd applauded again, and the king grinned.
Ah, now our performers need a volunteer.
He glanced up and down the high table in faux contemplation. Torsten Wolf looked like he had swallowed a lemon, and I thought the king would choose him, a punishment for his lack of enthusiasm. But then,
Fitzroy, why don't you come up here?
Fitzroy. Even I heard the danger in that word. William Fitzroy was the king's bastard son, and although most people referred to him by his surname, the king's name for him changed with his mood. He was my son when Fitzroy was in favor, or William, if a name was really needed. Fitzroy was a hint of dismissal, a reminder of his place in court, a surname they invented for the bastard son, the boy who wasn't supposed to exist. But Fitzroy sauntered forward without hesitation. His blonde hair fell across his eyes, giving him an air of casual confidence, and he was smiling, like he couldn't wait to suffer what his father had planned.
"Whatever my adoring fans demand," he said.
People laughed, and danger flashed in the king's eyes. The performers positioned Fitzroy in the middle of their group, and then began their show again, tossing flaming rings to one another over Fitzroy's head, sending knives spinning inches from his arms, breathing fire so close that his hair must have been singed. Fitzroy did not flinch. He mugged for the audience as the flames flew past, like nothing was more fun than nearly dying for everyone's entertainment. Fitzroy, I decided, was an idiot. The performance ended. Fitzroy bowed, and his father flicked a hand to send him back to his seat without a word. The performers departed the way they'd come, tumbling and dancing. The backflipper passed behind us again, and as she did, her foot caught on my shoulder. She didn't pause to apologize. She probably hadn't even noticed, so focused on her performance. But I jerked, shoved forward by her momentum, and my heart sputtered into triple time. The conversation in the hall started again, and Sophia and Claire leaped straight back into interrogating Naomi about her brother. I couldn't concentrate on the words. They were at once too loud and too far away to understand. My hands began to shake. The kick had triggered something in me, the awareness that people were too close. There were too many of them, and I couldn't leave, couldn't escape, couldn't do anything. No, I thought. Not here. I was safe. I was fine. It was too late. There were too many bodies, too much breath, and too many eyes. It was so loud, so crowded, and I couldn't leave. No, I told myself again. I would be calm. I tugged at the pins in my hair and looked around the room again, searching for something to ground me. The fountains of wine, the cascading flowers, the doves that still seemed confused about their inability to fly through the windows. Everything was safe. I'd be all right. I tugged at another hairpin, my hand shaking, and it slipped free, sending a section of hair tumbling to my shoulder. I grabbed it and tried to shove it back in place. Freya? I pressed my palms against my knees, willing my hands to still. I tried to force air to the bottom of my lungs. Freya, Naomi said again. Are you all right? I nodded, up and down and up. The world had turned fuzzy, and all the sounds were too loud, and people were so close, even those far away seemed to loom and press toward me, and I couldn't breathe, and, come on, Naomi said, let's get some air. I couldn't leave the table, it wasn't allowed, but Naomi was already standing, not touching me, just standing and waiting, and I felt myself standing, too. Naomi led the way to the doors at the back of the hall. They hadn't seemed far away before. 20 feet at most, but the distance stretched out now. Everyone was watching us leave. I knew, thinking about how odd we were behaving, and my father would be watching too, glowering. The door stood slightly open, and we stepped out into the gardens beyond. An October chill was in the air, and I gulped it in, stumbling farther from the palace. Calm. I was calm.
The world slowly came back into focus. The vast lawn had been decorated with floating lanterns and glistening ice statues, and couples walked between them, hands entwined, faces close. The river meandered through the garden at the bottom of a slight incline, reflecting the lanterns in the stairs. I staggered toward it, listening to the gurgle, looking at the lights. I was calm. I was calm. Naomi hovered about a foot away, watching me closely. "Are you all right?" I nodded. "Yes, yes, I'm fine." If I said it enough, it had to be true. "You don't have to be fine, you know, if you're not." Naomi said that every time this happened, and I always nodded like I actually believed her. It was one thing to be uncomfortable in court, to hate all the pretenses and be desperate to leave. It was quite another to panic, to become so frightened of the people around me that I forgot how to breathe. But she understood. She said her father reacted the same way to court, or to anything too crowded. That was why her parents lived out in the country, while she and her brother represented the family in the capital. Whenever I panicked, she would appear beside me, ready to talk me back to reality. She swept her 36 layers of skirts forward and sank onto the grass. It must have been cold, but she simply looked up at me with a smile until I settled beside her. At least I could breathe again. The chatter and music floated through the hall's open door, but it felt safer now, farther away. "Want me to take your hair down?" Naomi asked. I nodded. Naomi moved behind me and began pulling the pins loose with quick fingers. With every tug, my lungs relaxed, just a little. "How's the experiment going?" she said. "Any luck?" I shook my head. I'd been working on a way to create portable heat for weeks, something that could keep your hands warm and perhaps even banish the cold from my laboratory without fire. So far, all I had for my efforts were a whole lot of notes and a whole lot of burns. I plucked one of the loose hairpins from the grass and began to twist it between my fingers. The diamonds gleamed. "I've been experimenting with different metals," I said. "But nothing yet. I'll figure it out." Naomi tugged the last of my hair free, and I leaned back, falling onto the grass beside her. "When you figure it out, you'll be famous." She wrapped a loose strand of my hair around her fingers, moving it gently back and forth. Prickles ran across my scalp, and I closed my eyes. "Of course. Cold hands are the worst, Freya. People will pay you a lot of money if you figure it out. You could do anything you wanted after that." I shook my head. But secretly, I agreed. Not that I'd be famous. Perhaps. But that this would work. That this was my solution. If I could solve this and sell it, I'd have my own money. I could travel wherever I pleased, travel to the continent, convince a scientist to teach me there, stop living on the edge of other people's lives, and start living my own. I couldn't admit it, though, not even to Naomi. The thought was too thrilling and terrifying to share. If I said it out loud, even nodded at Naomi's suggestion, I felt, madly, irrationally, that it would be snatched away from me, just to punish me for believing. Naomi tucked her legs underneath her. "Well, you can be boring and unromantic if you like. I believe it'll happen. I'll miss you, though, when you're gone." "I won't leave you." It was the one downside to the plan, the one detail that made me hesitate. I wouldn't know what to do without Naomi beside me. "You'll come with me." I knew she wouldn't. She couldn't. Not with her parents' approval, at least. But I wanted to pretend. "I suppose I would like to see the continent. But what would Jacob do without me? He gets into too much trouble as it is." "He'll have to come and help you on your adventures," I said. "Rescue you when that dashing rogue you meet turns out to like girl bone soup. Because, of course, that'll happen to me. It happens to all the best heroines. And if your brother doesn't have to rush to your aid, how will he employ that handsome stranger to assist him who falls madly in love at the sight of you?" She laughed. "Well,
when you put it like that. She glanced toward the palace. Should we go back inside soon? They'll be missing us. They won't miss us. Everyone had already seen us go, and my father was going to be furious about that, whatever I did. At this point, I might as well leave entirely. I tapped my fingernail on the hairpin. Brand new, special for the banquet. Made from aluminum, which was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard. Someone on the continent had discovered a new metal, and what did everyone here do? Rush to make it into jewelry without a thought to what better uses it might have. I'd be there soon. On the continent, with real intellectuals, with people who actually cared rather than the vapid, fashion-hungry mob here. I just had to solve this one problem. Another tap of the hairpin. Metal hadn't worked. Not even close. But I hadn't tried aluminum. I sat up. "What is it?" Naomi said. "Aluminum. I haven't tried it yet for my experiment." My thoughts were racing. What if I combined it with something, maybe iodine? Yes. Yes, that would produce heat, wouldn't it? There were carriages around the front of the palace, waiting until they were needed. Surely one of them could take me home. My father must have noticed me leaving the hall, but he hadn't come looking for me. I could slip out for an hour or two, then come back and say I'd been in the gardens all along. He'd be angry, but he wouldn't be able to disprove it. The gardens were huge. He couldn't search them while I was gone, not without leaving the ball for longer than he'd deem acceptable himself. I could go back to the laboratory, try out my thoughts, and be back before the end of the feast. And if this worked, if it worked, I'd never have to go to a banquet like this again. Naomi grinned back at me. All right, she said. Let's go make your fortune. 2. It was easy enough to find a carriage. No one wanted to leave the social event of the year and miss whatever drunken gossip would fuel the next 2 months of court conversations, but the coachmen had to wait outside the gates with their horses, just in case. The streets were jammed with people. The king would never pay for commoners to celebrate with him. That would be a waste of good gold in his eyes. But if the taverns could use the king's birthday as a way to make a profit, and the people could use it as a way to have fun, then little things like invitations weren't going to deter them. It seemed I was the only one who wanted to hide at home tonight. It made me nervous. All those people, filling the road, blocking our escape. They were just people, nothing more than that. People who didn't even care who we were in the slightest, but knowing they were out there, all around us, that they had beating hearts and judging minds, that they might do anything and I couldn't predict it, that I couldn't run past them all. I twitched the curtains closed, but the shouts and laughter cut through the window, so I gripped my hands together in my lap, trying to remember to breathe. It must have taken half an hour or more to fight through the crowds, but finally, the carriage turned onto my street. Only nobles lived here, in black-beamed buildings from hundreds of years ago. Normally, that meant that anyone stepping out of the front door risked being accosted by nosy matriarchs and young social climbers, but the road was quieter now, and no lights flickered in the windows. Who would be here when they could be at the palace instead? Perhaps a few dedicated servants, an elderly relative telling the younger ones to have fun, and now, us. As soon as the carriage stopped, I shoved the door open, stumbling slightly as my heels hit the pavement. Naomi handed the driver a couple of coins, and I hurried to find the spare key tucked under the windowsill. The servants had been given the night off. Advisor to the king he might be, but my father remembered what working life was like before he married a noble, and he always thought about what the servants might want. He'd never admit to such improper behavior to any of his new peers, of course, but that didn't make his concern any less genuine. If only that concern stretched to his daughter. My happiness could never come before the expectations of the court. I had far too many supposed duties to fulfill. He wouldn't take it well when I finally left. He wouldn't hate me for it, exactly, but he wouldn't understand. So I couldn't tell him about my plans. I couldn't ask for any assistance. One day I'd inform him that I was leaving, and then I'd be gone. I wished things could be different. I wasn't close to my father, but I didn't want to hurt him. I wished he could understand, that he didn't wish for any daughter other than me, but wishes didn't mean anything in the end. This was how things had to be. The front hall was dark, the chandelier looming above us. I strode underneath it, to a narrow staircase at the far side of the room. Anyone visiting the house would probably dismiss it as a servant's passage, and one step into the run-down corridor at the bottom of the stairs would seem to confirm it. I didn't want anyone interrupting my experiments, and my father didn't want anyone to stumble across them. My laboratory wasn't perfect. The cellar room was cramped, for a start. A scarred wooden table took up most of the space, and I had personally fastened several sturdy but slightly lopsided cupboards to the walls. The only windows were high up, long rectangular panes of glass that looked straight on to the grass of our garden. They could be opened to let out smoke, but they were far less effective at letting in light. Books spilled off the shelves, and every spot of counter space was covered in bottles and vials and notes. But the busyness was comforting to me. Everything had a system, even if it was one I couldn't express in words. I knew where everything was. When I stepped into that room, all the doubt that defined my life in court melted away. I knew what I needed to do. I knew who I needed to be. I'd been interested in science for as long as I could remember, for longer than I'd had a word for it. I'd driven my mother and father insane with endless questions. Why is the sky blue? Why is fire hot? Why does food change when it's cooked? Why do people in different kingdoms speak different languages from us? Why? About anything and everything. My mother always indulged me with some ridiculous answer. Food cooked because it had big dreams, and it wanted to be the best it could be. The sky was blue because we were being watched by a giant, and she had the bluest eyes anyone had ever seen. When it rained, she was crying, and at night, it got dark because she was asleep. My father took the questions more seriously. He saw my curiosity as a good thing then, and as a merchant who traveled far, he had some answers, if not all of them. Of course, both approaches led to more questions about the giant or the languages spoken across the sea. But the first time I'd learned about science, the first time I'd realized that we didn't have all the answers and that some people worked to find them, was when I was about 8. My father mentioned his enthusiastic daughter to a scientist he'd met abroad, and the man gave my father a book called The Scientific Method, designed for students just beginning their studies. He'd said it was probably too dry for a child, but I became obsessed with it. The accompanying letter said I sounded like a very intelligent young lady, and he hoped I would keep asking questions. So I did. After my mother died, my father stopped traveling, but he also stopped caring about the court for a while. He just wanted me to be happy. So he let me build my lab. But as I got older and my mother's death faded from trauma into fact, my father became more concerned with her legacy. He needed a proper daughter with a future at court, not a stuttering scientist who planned to run as soon as she could. I'd left the laboratory door ajar. I stepped inside and began to light the lamps. Dagny was curled up on the center table, a perfect circle of fluff. She was precisely the wrong breed and color for a laboratory cat. All the dust and dirt stuck in her long gray fur, making her look like she'd been crawling up a chimney. But that didn't matter. She was my partner in science. Even if her contributions were restricted to meows that Naomi called assertive, and I called needy. She watched me as I talked through my ideas, like she was listening. Like she already had the answer in mind and was just waiting for me to catch up. And her intelligent eyes always coaxed the greatest breakthroughs from my brain. Now, I picked her up and moved her aside. She mewed with annoyance. "Well, what do you expect sleeping there?" I said. I've got work to do. I deposited her on a stool, and Naomi offered her a comforting rub under the chin. Dagny shut her eyes and tilted her head back, a ripple arching along her spine. Naomi was the world's best tamer of cats. Or maybe cats were excellent tamers of Naomi. She had no pets of her own, so she fussed over Dagny whenever she saw her. I'm not sure which one of them enjoyed it more. I squeezed past them, toward one of the cupboards on the far wall. Can you grab that flask from the countertop? The round one, wide at the base, narrow at the top? Dagny trilled as Naomi moved away. I opened the cupboard door to reveal rows and rows of jars, each with a different substance stored inside. The iodine was near the back. The silvery flakes were volatile, to say the least, so it was best to keep them tucked away, safe from mishap. I pulled out the jar and carried it back to the center table. Then I took the hairpin from my pocket and held it up to the light to consider it again. A butterfly clung to one end, its wings studded with diamonds. I snapped it off and placed it to one side. I couldn't allow it to adulterate the aluminum. Naomi, meanwhile, picked up the jar of iodine and considered the metal inside. How much do you think you should use? 3 pinches, I think. That would probably be safe. Less wouldn't tell me anything, and more might work a little too well if things didn't go as I expected. Dagny was too busy rubbing her head against Naomi's arm to give her opinion. With my thick leather gloves firmly in place and my goggles tight over my eyes, I twisted open the jar and used tongs to move 3 pinches of iodine into the flask. Then I carefully added the hairpin. Nothing happened. It needs something, I said, something to encourage it to react. I glanced at Dagny to make sure she was still a safe distance away, and then grabbed a pipette and went to fill it up with water. Maybe you should stand back for this, I said to Naomi, just in case. But it's okay if it explodes in your face? It won't explode in my face. I wasn't going to be wrong. I could feel it. But just in case. Naomi made a face at me, but she did step away. I squeezed a couple of drops of water into the flask. For 1 second, and then 2, nothing happened. Then bright purple smoke began to billow from the hairpin. Not what I had been expecting. The aluminum sparked. I jumped back just before it burst into flames. The smoke billowed from the flask, getting thicker and more purple. My lungs tightened as the smoke swelled toward me and I coughed. Dagny hissed in protest and dove under the chair. The smoke grew and grew, the fire casting purple light across the room. I held my breath and counted to 3, giving myself time to note the exact shade of purple, the intensity of the reaction, the speed with which it seemed to burn. Then I ran to the window and heaved it open, letting fresh air rush in. Naomi clambered onto the counter to haul open the second window, her toes balanced between more flasks. Dagny meowed again. She wasn't pleased. I know, I said, as I fanned the smoke toward the open window. But breakthroughs don't come from being cautious. And nothing bad happened. Iodine is only a bit poisonous. Only a bit poisonous? Naomi said. Freya, only if you eat it, or touch it, or inhale its fumes. But we hadn't breathed in much. We'll be fine. Naomi glared at me, eyebrows raised. Which, yes, all right, perhaps she had a point. It hadn't been entirely safe, but science wasn't safe. You had to take risks, and I was wearing goggles and gloves, and I'd made sure she stepped back. Plus, we'd learned something new. Wasn't that the most important thing? That was amazing, I said as I moved back toward the flask. Did you see that smoke? That purple was pretty impressive. Not quite a hand warmer, though. A distorted white lump remained stuck to the bottom of the flask, and it split when I tried to remove it. Even I wasn't eager enough to add more water to it without further research, so I put the pieces in a jar of their own and labeled it aluminum iodine. Maybe I'd have a use for it once I learned more. I grabbed my journal from its spot on the far end of the desk while Naomi sank onto the stool beside me. Aluminum, I scrawled, the ink smudging slightly. Did not react as expected. I frowned as I wrote, making sure to describe the exact color of the product, the scent, and thickness of the smoke. That attempt had failed, but there had to be something useful in it. If you mixed metal with iodine and added water, it burned. This one had been too hot, obviously, and reacted too fast. But maybe if I tried something else, something that changed gradually but still produced heat. I glanced at the clock on the wall. 10 p.m. One more attempt, and then I'd return to the ball. 3 attempts later, Naomi settled on the chair in the corner and pulled a book from between the cushions. She always had at least one novel stashed somewhere in the lab, so she could sit with Dagny purring on her lap, half listening to my rambling, as she read and I worked. My whole body buzzed. I was on the right path. I knew it. Every metal that burned too hot or barely reacted at all brought me closer to finding the one that was right, closer to finally starting the life I wanted. How perfect would it be if I solved all my problems on the night of the king's birthday? If I sealed my escape from the court on the one night a year when I had to be there? I'd never have to step inside that ballroom again. After the 7th attempt, I checked the clock again. 2 a.m. That didn't seem right. It had only been an hour, I was sure. But the king's parties always went on forever. I had plenty of time to return. I glanced at Naomi again. Her eyes were closed now, and she was breathing gently. Dagny had curled up with her paws, chin and tail on top of the book, to make sure that Naomi couldn't ignore her. But Naomi was clearly asleep, and Dagny was too, their chests rising and falling in sync. The sun was peeking in through the windows when I became aware of time again. I was pouring spirit of nitre into a flask, holding my breath, willing my hand to remain steady, when heavy footsteps crossed the floor above. I jumped. Spirit of nitre flew across the table, and I swore, earning a startled look from Dagny. The party must have ended. My father was going to murder me. I grabbed a cloth and quickly mopped up the liquid. If anyone touched this with their bare hands, Naomi sat up. What's going on? Her hair had half collapsed, revealing the wire structure underneath. She shoved the dome back onto her head. I heard something upstairs. Probably my father. Maybe the feast wasn't over. Maybe he had noticed my absence and finally come looking for me. I wasn't sure if that would be better or worse. When I had left the New Year celebrations early to study, he'd locked me out of my laboratory for a month. No experiments, no research, not even access to my books, even though I'd attended the ball for at least an hour. That should have been punishment enough for any later transgressions. More footfalls, pounding down the stairs. They were too heavy to be maids, but too many to be just my father. Had he brought the whole court to berate me? It had to be somebody else. Thieves, perhaps? Opportunistic criminals who expected the manor to be empty during the ball? I'd assume that intruders would at least try to be stealthy, but if they thought the entire place abandoned... I grabbed a pair of iron tongs and held them in front of me, staring at the laboratory door. Freya? Naomi swiped the small shovel from the fireplace. Who do you think it is? I didn't reply. It couldn't be anyone good. But if we kept quiet, they probably wouldn't look here. It was a run-down old laboratory underneath the house. Not a likely hiding place for jewels. Freya? Freya, are you down here? It was my father. But he didn't sound angry. His voice was too loud. Almost desperate. Fearful. Something was wrong. Before I could even lower my weapon, the door crashed open, and my father barreled into the room. Titus Nystrom was usually a calm and collected man, with a smile for everyone and a quick wit to match. He had to be, to convince the court that a merchant, of all people, could be allowed to walk among them. He did not look calm now. His hair was rumpled, his skin blanched and clammy. He wasn't wearing his jacket, and he had lost his cravat somewhere on the way. My father never looked anything less than polished. Dread settled in my stomach. Freya! He ran over to me and pulled me into a hug, squeezing so tightly that the breath rushed out of my lungs. You're alive! Alive? I scrambled to make sense of the word. Why wouldn't I be alive?
There was an attack.
He seized me by the shoulders and inspected my face.
I thought, but you're here. You're here. You're safe.
Four palace guards crowded into the laboratory behind him. They wore dark blue coats, embroidered with the king's three gold stars. A sword and dagger hung from each of their left hips. I stared at them, the way they clutched the hilts of their weapons. I'd never seen the guards do anything before, except stand silently behind the king. But they were alert now, ready to act. I had to ask my father what had happened. I had to force the words out, had to know, but they got stuck somewhere in the knot that had formed at the top of my chest, and I just stared.
"Sir," Naomi said, "what's happened?"
My father let go of me and stared at her, like he hadn't even realized she was there.
"Naomi," he said, "is there anyone else here, anyone with you?"
"No,"
I said. "No, no one but us. Father, what's going on?"
"Poison," he said. "At the banquet. Everyone is dead, Rhea. Everyone."
The words didn't make sense. I stepped away, the small of my back thudding against the table. Dagny butted her head against my side, and I dug my fingers into the fur around her neck. I could feel the rise and fall of her breath.
"What do you mean everyone is dead?"
"Everyone is dead. Something was poisoned, the food or the wine, and it killed them. The king, the queen, the king's brother, his nephew, they're all dead."
Cyanide could asphyxiate its victims in under 10 seconds. The thought floated across my empty skull, so clinical, unwanted. Everyone was dead. Dead. Naomi grabbed my arm to steady herself.
"My brother was at the ball," she said to my father. "Did you see him? Is he all right?"
"I don't know," my father said. "Several hundred are dead. Too many to know exactly who. When I couldn't find you, Freya, I thought..."
I stared at him, running over the words, checking and then checking again that I'd heard correctly. It didn't make sense. It couldn't make sense.
"But you're alive."
"I was lucky. I was distracted. I wasn't eating at the feast."
"So other people survived?"
Naomi said. Her grip on my arm was painfully tight.
"Other people are still alive?"
"Some," my father said. "Not many. I haven't seen your brother. I have to go."
She let go of my arm.
"I have to look for him. I'll go with you."
That thought at least made sense to me. Naomi needed help. I could help her. I clung to the idea, the clarity of it. But my father grabbed me, holding me in place.
"No, it isn't safe, Freya. You can't go back.
You said they were poisoned, so it won't be dangerous to go back now."
"Some are still. Not everyone is dead yet, Freya. And I can't risk you. We can't risk you. Not now."
"You can't risk me?"
"There's no risk."
"No one would ever want to attack me." "We'll bring gloves. We won't touch anything. It'll be safe."
"No, Freya!"
He grabbed both of my shoulders again.
"Listen. Hundreds of people died, and more are close to it. The whole line to the throne is dead.
So we should help those who are left.
Listen to me, Freya. Everyone is dead. Everyone before you. That makes you queen. You can't go back there."
I laughed. It wasn't funny. Not any of it. But the sound ripped out of me. The only way I could react to the ridiculousness of it. I'd seen them. Alive. Only a few hours before.
"I can't be queen."
"This is not a joke, Freya."
He spoke sharply now, almost aggressively.
"The first one in the line of succession to survive is you."
"No, I'm 23rd in line."
I was as likely to rule as Dagny was. That was why I was allowed to skip balls. Why I was permitted to spend my time in the laboratory. Why no one would even have noticed that I left the grounds tonight. I didn't matter. I was nobody to them.
"Freya, listen to what I am saying. Someone wanted to destroy the court tonight. They wanted to kill the entire line to the throne, and they almost succeeded. You are the first one left."
"I couldn't be queen. I couldn't. So many people would have to die for me to inherit the throne, and they couldn't be gone. I'd seen them a few hours ago, all alive completely themselves. I'd never liked most of them, but I hadn't wanted them to die. Dagny butted against my hand, and I swept her up into my arms, hugging her so tightly she mewed in protest. "But my brother," Naomi said, "he's ahead of me in line to the throne. Ahead of me, but after Freya. What happened to him?" "I don't know." My father was almost shouting now. "I didn't see him. He may have left himself." Naomi stumbled toward the door. Her legs didn't seem able to hold her weight. "I have to get back to the palace. I have to know. I have to look." But the guards blocked the doorway, and they did not step aside.
"We cannot let you go, my lady," one said.
"I have to see my brother."
"No," my father said. "No, they're right. You're in line to the throne, too. 36ths before tonight. You have to be protected as well."
Naomi shook her head, over and over, but the guards still didn't move.
"We must act quickly," my father said. "I'm sure our enemies are already planning to take advantage of the situation. We have to move now, before they have time to act against you."
"We don't have enemies," I said. "How could we have enemies?"
"You're queen, Freya, and we must ensure you remain that way. We need to leave, now. We shall have the servants fetch whatever you need later."
He gestured for me to place Dagny back on the table. I tightened my grip. I was not leaving Dagny behind, not now. Contrary to what many people seemed to think, I wasn't a fool. I read my history books. I knew how these things ended. The fights over who was the rightful heir, the fate of hapless girls shoved at the throne because of tenuous family connections, the overbold young men with dreams of glory. If I claimed my supposed throne, I'd be sticking out my neck for anyone to take a swing. And if I failed to hold the crown... But if I didn't claim the throne, I'd still be in danger. Who would leave the rightful heir alive if they wanted to control the throne themselves? I wasn't going to leave Dagny behind tonight. Dagny helped me think. Dagny helped me breathe. I was going to need both of those things if I was going to survive this. "I'll go," I said. "But someone needs to look for Naomi's brother. They have to help her." I looked at the guards, waiting for them to move. Instead, they looked to my father.
"Very well," my father said. "Someone will look for him, but Naomi must come with us."
He gestured at the door, but didn't move. I didn't move either. He was waiting for me to walk through first, because I held precedence now. Because I was the queen. I couldn't be the queen. I grabbed Naomi's hand and squeezed it before stepping forward. My legs shook. Queen. I was queen. 3. News of the attacks had clearly already spread. Even more people crowded the streets now than they had last night, and the air seemed to have changed, heavy with fear. People shouted at our carriage as we squeezed past. "Is it true? Is the king hurt? Is the king dead?" Crowds bumped against the carriage, and the horses danced out of the way. Our curtains were clipped shut, barely letting any light through, preventing anyone from seeing me and my guards. But what would they think, even if they could see me? I was just a girl clutching a cat, not exactly someone who looked like they had information.
"There should be guards on the streets," my father murmured. "This could turn into a riot."
I clutched my hands in my lap, squeezing my knuckles until they turned white. A riot? I could picture it like it was already happening. The people screaming, running, our carriage knocked over in the panic. But it wasn't happening now. It wouldn't happen. It was fine. It was fine.
"We are trying, my lord," one of the guards said. "We were all taken by surprise."
I looked across at Naomi. Her fear was a physical presence in the carriage, but I couldn't think what to say. Anything reassuring felt like a lie. I was terrible with words, and now that they really did matter, I didn't have a clue how to help her.
As the carriage jerked around a corner, Naomi began to shake, and Dagny struggled out of my arms and crossed the seat. She butted against Naomi's side and licked her hand, purring. Naomi stroked her, but she did not turn to look. I squeezed my eyes closed. Calm. I had to remain calm. But all my fears jumbled together, each one passing too quickly to process. Everyone was dead. I was queen. Someone had tried to kill us all. I was queen. How could I be queen? Each idea felt disconnected from the others, and I couldn't focus on any of them. I couldn't breathe. No. I could handle this. I just needed to focus on the problem. I couldn't solve the deaths, and the thought of being queen was still too big, too impossible. So I would focus on the murders, the abstract concept of them, the logic behind it. Someone had tried to wipe out the entire court last night. But who? Why? I hadn't heard so much as a whisper of discontent, and the king's spies couldn't have either. Or this would never have happened. There had to be some motive, something that made sense. Someone at the feast, probably, with some connections to the kitchen, in order to kill everyone so quietly and effectively. And who had they intended to survive, intended to rule? My life was an accident, that much I was sure of. No one would plot to place me on the throne. So had the murderer intended to wipe out everybody, every single noble in court? Or had they had another ruler in mind, another survivor further down the line? Our carriage moved against the flow of the crowd, away from the palace. Once the sounds of the crowds faded, I unclipped the curtains and peered out. "Freya!" my father hissed. I ignored him. The same. Everything looked the same. The world had not shifted. It looked like the start of another normal day. A stern stone castle loomed on a hill ahead of us. I didn't know its official name, but everyone here called it the fort. The name did little to capture its true terror. It was a single square tower, built of black stone, surrounded by a dark moat. Once it had been the home of the king, when warring nobles were a constant threat. Then it had become a prison for the kingdom's most dangerous enemies. But even that was rarely needed any longer. The fort was more of a warning than a weapon these days, but it was kept in readiness in case the king needed protection. "We're going to the fort?" I said. My father nodded. "It's the only place that's safe." The drawbridge across the moat hadn't been raised for at least 200 years. I'd thought the chains and pulleys must have rusted closed from disuse, but the bridge had been lifted now, preventing anyone from approaching. Another two guards blocked the road at the edge of the moat. "Halt!" one shouted as the carriage drew near. "Who goes there?" "It is your queen," my father said. "Let us through." The guards did not lower their swords. "Step out of the carriage." I pinched the skin between my thumb and my forefinger, swallowing my fear. If these guards didn't want me as queen, they could easily kill me. In all the chaos, no one would ever notice. My guards stepped out of the carriage, their own swords raised, and my father nodded for me to follow. I grabbed Dagny before I moved. Her wriggling warmth kept my hands steady. The men on the road frowned as I emerged, like they were trying to figure out who I was. They relaxed slightly when they saw my father. "Titus," one said. "You survived." "I did. As did my daughter. Please, let us through. Who knows what may happen if we linger here?" "Of course." The guard bowed to me. If he thought bowing to a soot-covered teenager clutching a large cat was strange, he didn't show it. "Please, follow me." He led us partway around the moat, to a point where the bank was slightly less steep. A man sat in a boat halfway across, and when he saw the guard, he rowed for the shore. Rubbish floated on the water, detritus from the river that had been swept here and become stuck. Something to do with tides, I thought vaguely. The sea was miles and miles away, but I was certain I'd heard that. The fort's moat always stank because of something to do with tides. The boat bumped against the shore, and a guard grabbed it before nodding for me to step inside. It bobbed as I shifted my weight onto the deck, and I squeezed Dagny tight, suddenly certain I was going to go flying into the water.
"Keep good hold of that cat, young miss," the boatman